along with Professor Peter Ward. And I think a number of you thought he was taking a nasty shot at the movie The Day After Tomorrow. He wasn't. He's well aware of who had involvement with that movie and the book from which it came. So not to worry. People took that the wrong way. It's interesting watching the fast blast come in. Professor Peter Ward is my guest. In a moment, we'll delve more. You know, when I think of the ocean, and I'm sure when many of you think of the ocean, we think of it as the source of virtually all life, that from which life came. And when we begin to hear about dead zones, as many as 200 dead zones in the world's oceans, I don't know, it sends a little, a little charge of something down the back of the neck. We'll talk about more of that in a moment. Unless you believe that man crawled from the ocean, or no, let me correct that, that man was sort of plucked down on the Earth 12 or 13,000 years ago. The traditional scientific belief, of course, is that we originally crawled in some way from the ocean and then evolved to what we are today. Professor Ward, we think of the ocean or the world's oceans as the source of all life, really. And so it is very disturbing to me to hear about dead zones. Moreover, I don't understand them. The ocean is, the world's oceans are this giant moving, sloshing, changing environment. And it just doesn't seem likely that you would have these zones of absolute death, which is, I guess, what they are. Do they find some life within these, or are they absent all life?
No, they're filled with life, all right, but it's not animal life. No animal has ever figured out how to live in a low or zero oxygen environment. But the bacteria do, the microbes, lots of microbes, can only live in zero oxygen. We wouldn't have fermentation and all the great delights of alcohol if we didn't have lots of microbes who could live in zero oxygen conditions.
Well, okay, but again, from a pedestrian point of view, which is where I'm coming from, these oceans are giant, sloshing, moving things. How do we manage to come up with zones of dead?
Well, the dead is when you can somehow cut off the free exchange of oxygen from the surface, the atmosphere down to the bottom. You do it a couple of ways. You can make your atmosphere have less oxygen, and that's what happened in the past, what I tried to show in this book that I wrote. But the second way is to change circulation. And I didn't mean the crack at the movie. I actually got a script of it. The last time we spoke, I had been given a script before it came out, and you and I had a wonderful conversation about this. But the speed of it was too fast. In the movie, everything happened so quickly. They would drop such temperatures so quickly. It's not going to be that fast, but the premise of the movie is right on.
Right. Well, it had to be fast. It was a, you know, less than 2-hour movie. I mean, you can only do so much on it.
True enough. 2 hours. Yeah. No, the dead zones are increasing in size. I live right next to a beautiful body of water called Puget Sound, and we have a big arm of it called Hood Canal, which is very long. It's tens of miles long, and it is absolutely dead now. The last sort of gasp was this summer. This isn't a deep ocean. This is a fjord, and it's happening in Norway. Well, as you know, it's happening in many places. The Gulf of Mexico is especially scary. But when they go from oxygenated to non-oxygenated, it's the microbes that change. And they're packed. The more, the less oxygen you get, actually, the more microbes you can get. And it's these nasty devils that produce the toxins and the gases that are so poisonous.
So when they say dead zones, they really mean dead. No fish?
Well, they just mean dead animal zones. They're alive. I mean, they're just teeming with life, but no animals.
Well,
animals, no.
So no fish?
No fish. No fish, no invertebrates, no clams, no crabs, no worms, none of the 35 body plans that we call animals, not one. We animals have ever figured out how to live in a no-oxygen environment.
So how concerned about these dead zones should we be?
Very much so. I have a friend named David Battisti, who's one of the best climate specialists on the planet. Mm-hmm. And he and I had this conversation. I've written two books, Boom Boom. The first one's coming out about oxygen. The second one is carbon dioxide, and it'll be out in 6 months. And it is how carbon dioxide really causes the heat that causes the mass extinctions. And at the end of that book, I really have this conversation with him, and it was so desperately sad to me because I asked him, what are we going to do? And he said, nothing can happen until there's a world government. There can never be a world government until we have a catastrophe of such, if I may say, biblical proportions that people come to the realization that we have no political system that can deal with the changes that global warming are going to produce. And he's...
Professor, that's scary as hell. I'm reading a story right now. It's actually been out for a while now. The world's chief climatologist and the people at NOAA are all complaining bitterly that they are writing stories, they're writing memos about this, they're writing all kinds of things about this, and these things are being suppressed. These things are not allowed to hit the media. They're being censored. Are you running into this?
Well, I'm running into it in a different fashion, actually. My bread and butter was astrobiology. I don't know if you noticed, but the funding for astrobiology was cut in half. And the reason being is that an awful lot of what astrobiology does is study evolution. And the United States government made the decision that they didn't want so much funding going into evolution. Well, the same thing happened to the global warming scientists. And there was the famous case where a very high up NASA scientist who was studying global warming through satellites was essentially muzzled. It was muzzled by order of the White House. Well, there was the hue and cry. But this is a world problem, and that no one government is going to be able to solve it or even get a handle on it. When we think that we are now at, 6 billion people, and we're shooting towards 10 within the next, 50, 60, 70 years, we've got a big problem, and the biggest problem is going to be China and India in terms of dealing with the atmosphere, because they will be the industrialized countries with oil going down. They will both have to be using coal, and they'll be using plants which are not up to sort of environmental standards that we have in America today. And so we're really looking, I think, at a catastrophe because of carbon dioxide, again, rising above 1,000 ppm. Once it gets to 1,000, all bets are off about what happens next.
Well, I've been trying to figure out the reasoning behind muzzling these scientists. Now, they're reporting bad news. They're reporting news that, if taken to heart, would require changes that would be hurtful for our economy. There's no question about that. Do you think that's the reason, if you just want to speculate for a moment, for muzzling these scientists? Do you think that the politicians are well enough informed to know, for example, that there's nothing essentially that we can do about all of this, that it's going to happen no matter what we do, so we might as well smile and be happy and enjoy what time we have left?
I don't think the politicians, many of them, because are well enough educated in science to really take a read on it. This is the sad thing. We're living in a world where you need highly technical people to make highly technical decisions, and yet the pathway to politics is always through law school. And so these folks are smart people, all right, but their smartness is involved in huge, detailed study of the law, not natural science. And so we don't have people with the experience or the breadth or the view to get a hold of what's happening on this scale. And secondly, I think you're entirely correct. I think that the realization, at least in the American government, is that the fixes would require big hits to the economy. And the parties in power don't want to lose power, and it's just too painful to them. So they won't make...
Well, there is a valid question, though, and I've been trying to figure out why the muzzling is going on. Could it be that they've calculated that they really cannot hit the economy or not? There's really nothing they can do to change it. And if that's the case, then all the warnings in the world don't make a whole lot of difference, because realistically, they cannot change it, so they might as well not deal with it.
That's a great question, Art. I mean, that is the best of all questions. There's a wonderful website called realclimate.org, which has, I think, the best climate scientists in the world. batting back and forth, that and others. I personally am an optimist simply because, well, it doesn't sound like it sometimes, the other view is just too terrible to comprehend. But there are an awful lot of things that can be done. And some of the large-scale engineering jobs, you know, the ocean is capable of taking up a huge amount of carbon dioxide. And we can bury it away in any number of ways. It wouldn't take a huge, huge, huge effort if all of the world made the same sort of fixes simultaneously. As long as, my people tell me, as long as we don't get above 450 to 500 parts per million, if we can stem it at that, we're going to avoid major catastrophe.
That'd be nice.
If we can't stem it, we're in real trouble.
Ms. Kane from Portland, Oregon, and by the way, there is a dead zone off the Oregon coast, asks, is there any natural systemic event that might rebalance Earth's atmospheric gases?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the Earth has ways. If we shut off all of the carbon dioxide that we are spewing into the atmosphere, well, the Earth mm-hmm. is very good at scrubbing itself clean of the excess toxins. People ask me, what can we do about too much carbon dioxide? And I tongue-in-cheek say, well, just turn off all the volcanoes and you can drive as much as you want to. Because let's face it, natural processes are dumping huge amounts of CO2. They always have, they always will. If we could plug up all the volcanoes, drive as much as you want, of course, that's never going to happen. Again, it is going to take a concerted societal effort to reduce emissions. If that happens, we avoid the big catastrophes.
Uh-huh. Mother Earth, I've frequently said, doesn't get angry. She gets even. And is it possible that at some point the Earth could simply decide that we, human beings, are excess toxins that need to be wiped away?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but what my favorite quote comes from the guy who really thought up the conveyor belt situation, Wally Broker, which your movie and the movie script itself really came from. And Wally mm-hmm. Broker said, the Earth's climate is like a wild beast, and we're poking it with sharp sticks.
Right.
And I really think that really sort of describes what's going on here. Katrina was no joke, and those who think that Katrina is just another of a natural sense of these hurricanes, of course the global warming is going to increase the ferocity of hurricanes. We have this year missed out, but you, in your part of the world, I've noticed there have been some horrendous typhoons already in the Pacific end of things.
Oh, my God. One after another after another. We've had some really scary stuff over here.
Yeah, your half of the world has been, this year, you've been whacked, and so has the west coast of Mexico. Baja California has been slapped a couple of times. So people look at the Atlantic and say, aha, look, not much, no wreckage this year, therefore it's crisis over. But it's a global system, as you know. It's just crazy to have this parochial look.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing. If you take the world's continents and you put them together like a puzzle piece, they do indeed come together like a puzzle piece, indicating that one time they were united, and then they split apart. Is there any chance the continents could get on the move again and either come back together or, I don't know, combine in some new state?
Well, they are on the move, and there's a couple of scientists who are tracking these moves and have predicted out as far away as 300 million years into the future what these directions and the best probabilities are. Of course, the farther off into the future you are, the less accurate your prediction. But it turns out the continents have been like bumper cars. I used to love bumper cars. You go run around, smash into somebody else, and continents do that.
Yes.
Once you
mm-hmm.
smack into somebody, you go smack somebody else. But every once in a while, all these smacked continents all held together, as you alluded to, called a supercontinent. The last time that happened was the greatest single mass extinction in the history of the planet. Something about producing these supercontinents causes oxygen to drop like a rock and CO2 to increase. This is when we get these big flood basalts, is when the continents really come together. Now, they've been splitting apart for some time, but the directionality suggests that we're moving back towards the supercontinent. We should be back at that state in about 200 million years, and I fully expect that there will be once again one of these enormously horrendous catastrophes, if not before. Now, I can live with 200 million years before we have another mass extinction, but if we push harder on CO2, it'll be a lot sooner than that.
All right. Professor, I'm going to ask you, this is just a what-if question, and it's kind of like an earlier question in a sense, and it is this. If you saw an event in the near term that represented virtually an extinction-level event for the human race, would you be inclined to report it and allow the people of Earth to know that it's coming, to know the end is near? Or would a more rational conclusion be that you couldn't do a damn thing about it, and so instead of going out in a fit of madness, you might as well allow life to go on for as long as it can, as normally as it can, and then let whatever's going to happen, happen?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think I might go for the latter. It's kind of like the doctor who's just discovered that his patient has terminal cancer.
Right.
You tell them? Of course they always tell them. They have to by whatever ethics there are. But wouldn't it be nicer to just go up till the last couple of days and then you're finally told? I think of the agony knowing that the end is near. So that's a really tough ethical question. Luckily, I'm a peon. I never have to worry about it.
Well, not so much of a peon, Professor. It is entirely possible that you would come to be in possession of this sort of knowledge, and you would have that ethical question when it came to, do I tell the people in power about it? Do we get a lot of scientists together, sign a letter, send it to the president? What do we do?
Well, the whole idea that this hydrogen sulfide has spewed out is only a year and a half old, and I did my bit of trying to alert everybody. This month, Scientific American has a huge, long article I wrote about the dangers of this and the fact that it could happen again. And I have, at least I hope I have, an interview with Al Gore to put one more slide into his famous slideshow, because this is a global warming, very scary global warming phenomenon that he doesn't yet have in his Inconvenient Truth. He's coming to Seattle in a month and a half, and I fully expect to meet with him and try to explain this new and awful wrinkle.
Well, no offense to Al Gore, but a lot of people are politically polarized, and even if Al Gore had a new slide, which virtually showed an ELE, I don't think all that many people would pay attention.
I'm sure you're right. It's just that at some point, you know, I hark back to the movie Network, where the man finally says, you know, I'm mad as heck, and I'm not going to take it anymore. And many of we scientists have gotten to that point about climate change, and that one yells as loudly as possible in the way that one can. And for we scientists, it's not sticking our heads out windows, but it's writing. And hopefully that the writing actually gets somewhere. But you know as well as I do that most of these articles and most of the books are read by the true believers already. It's virtually impossible to jump to people who are unprepared or unwilling to read into what we were trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, if something came along that was that threatening, I'm not sure, to be honest with you, that there would be that much point in telling everybody about it. And I can easily see how our politicians would conclude that there would be simply no point in reporting this, that we'd go out in a sort of a Mad Max type scenario where everybody decided to run the credit cards up to the limit, and that would be the least of the violent reactions.
You may be right. I just don't think the politicians are astute enough to, or would know, were it shown to them that this is going to happen, that they'd either believe it or be smart enough to hide it.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything, I might as well go ahead and ask, in the near term, Professor, that just scares the hell out of you? And when I say near term, I don't mean the next millions of years ahead. I mean in the relative near term.
Yeah, I have a 9-year-old boy, and I'm quite convinced that during his lifetime or the lifetime of his children, there will be a climate-induced mass mortality of humans on this planet beyond anything that we can currently imagine.
I'm thinking
of the tens to hundreds of millions of deaths.
All right. We will explore exactly that when we get back. Professor Peter Ward is my guest, and if it's Fright Night you want, it's Fright Night we've got. From Manila, I'm Art Bell. Good day, all. Professor Peter Ward is my guest, and he just made a kind of an interesting comment when I asked him if there was anything in the near term that we should be very concerned about. Said, yes, if you have a child, that in that child's life he would expect that tens of millions will die due to something. We'll find out what that is in a moment. Once again, Professor Peter Ward. All right, Professor, what is it that our children might be concerned about that would kill tens of millions?
I think the greatest threat is the melting of the ice caps, and this is going back into your territory. Certainly, when we're melting Greenland at a very rapid rate, and we're starting to melt Antarctica. Sea level rises from Greenland alone would certainly be sufficient to flood a huge amount of the world's deltas. It turns out about 20 to 25% of the world's crops come from low-lying coastal areas. I mean, it's not the highlands that do it. And if we only have to raise sea level about 2 meters, 6 feet, to effectively remove 10%, 20% of the arable land area in the coastal zones. And this is by far the best soil. You know, it's not just covering it up, as you know, Art. It's when sea level rises, it moves up the aquifers where fresh water sits. We're seeing this now in the Sacramento and the San Joaquin Valley. Salt is being injected ever higher up into the valley itself. So with the rising sea level caused by the melting of Greenland right now, the worst case prediction is what's going to happen to Bangladesh. Bangladesh is at sea level, essentially. If you have sea level rise from 6 to 12 feet, let's say, even a 6-foot rise has a huge effect on the planet. But a 12-foot rise displaces, I believe, it's 28 million people in Bangladesh alone. That's one country. Now, displacement on a global scale involves famine. It involves hardship. My guess is that what is going to happen is that the rise in sea level is going to unleash the nuclear genie, that the changes in countries, the mass migrations, and the difference in some countries having food and others aren't are going to lead to warfare here, there, and everywhere. And sooner or later, somebody's going to pop out a nuke and take out a city or several cities.
Anyway, well, it's now possible, Professor, excuse me, to navigate, I believe already now possible to navigate across the North Pole in a ship. Because the ice is gone. Polar bears are beginning to drown. All kinds of things are beginning to happen. They've taken satellite pictures of what's going on, for example, at the North Pole. And I've had them put up on the website from time to time. And people look at them, and they're astounding to see. I mean, you know, with 40% or better of the ice gone, people just go, oh, 40% of the ice gone. It just seems as though the melting at the top of the world and the beginning of it at the bottom of the world is something that humanity just can't ignore, and yet we are.
You're entirely correct, Art. And once again, the melting has a second effect. As you well know, when you dump fresh water onto the conveyor belt circulation systems, which are run by thermohaline differences, you cause them to change positions and change and stop, essentially. And this is, again, the premise of the movie The Day After Tomorrow. Absolutely correct. Changing that system, which is what the movie was based on, caused and will cause catastrophe. I'm not sure that they had it worked out, but they certainly are correct that it is a huge threat facing our world.
Well, again, Professor, I'm not sure that that our politicians have it wrong. In other words, if they really know all of this is going on and it's significant, possibly even leading to some sort of extinction or near extinction for a portion of the population, but there's absolutely nothing they can really do about it. I mean, they're not going to turn the U.S. economy and other economies on their ear. They're just not going to do it. So with that in mind, Perhaps they're muzzling people because, well, that's all they can really do. That's the only thing, the only effect they can have. They can't change the melting, but they can stop the news.
Well, the muzzling is certainly taking place, so that is sure. And there's two ways to do it. You can overtly muzzle, as is what happened to the NASA official. But the second way to do it is to cut funding. And in this, at least in the American science establishment, you know, many of us have been watching with dismay. Even though budgets supposedly are going up, there aren't. In real dollars, funding to science is dropping. And increasingly now we're seeing that the diversion of money that's absolutely necessary to keep the Iraq war going is affecting the scientific establishment. There are other areas. We're putting so much money into the space station, for instance, and its effective life is coming to an end fairly soon before it's finished. I think we really must redirect the scarce scientific funds towards those problems most relevant to the survival and the well-being of humanity.
If they're soluble. Professor, there was a lake, I can't recall where, in Europe, where there was a sudden methane release, which actually killed a lot of animals and people, and I can't recall exactly where or when.
Yep, it was in 1982, Lake Nyos. Perhaps there was one in Europe, but the one I know is Lake Nyos in Cameroon, Africa. Mm-hmm. It killed 3,000 people and I think 12,000 livestock. In the middle of the night, a big bubble of carbon dioxide came out of the lake. Methane, too, and you're absolutely correct about that, smothered everybody and killed them dead. It's exactly that set of physics that I'm arguing in this new book that I'm trying to get anybody to look at out of thin air. That's exactly the mechanism that caused the past mass extinctions. The gas, the only difference, the gas was hydrogen sulfide, which is far more toxic. I had chemistry labs, Art, and we had hydrogen sulfide labs. They were finally discontinued in the chemistry courses the world over because undergrads were keeling over. I mean, this is really hideous stuff. And what hydrogen sulfide does, it not only kills you directly, it breaks down ozone. So during these mass extinction events, the H2S goes up into the atmosphere. Animals breathe it and die. But more importantly, it hits the ozone layer. All ozone disappears, and the Earth is absolutely unprotected from ultraviolet radiation.
Gee, without Professor, ozone, perhaps out of thin air is a great title for a book like that. The methane. Now, there's a lot of methane at the bottom of our oceans right now. Is that correct?
There sure is.
Uh-huh. Okay, is there any mechanism, Professor, that would cause that methane to be released in large quantities?
You know, it's a great question, Art, and you might get on as a guest. I've never spoken to him, but there's a professor at Northwestern University called Gregory Riskin, R-Y-S-K-I-N. And Riskin, for years, has been trying to get a paper published suggesting that these big methane bubbles, not hydrogen sulfide, as I'm arguing in my papers, but actual methane bubbles are coming out of the oceans in the past, and he is predicting, and you know, I laugh, but it's just so hideous, that the Black Sea has so much methane on its bottom that it could have one of these big bubbles come out. If it's hit by lightning, it explodes. And he has this paper in which he's predicting, because of wind directions, that China could get totally burned to the ground by a Black Sea methane bubble. This was a couple of years ago, and if you just Google Riskin, you get this great, scary view of what methane can do.
All right. Gregory Riskin?
Yeah, R-Y-S-K-I-N from Northwestern. He's a professor of chemistry. He knows this stuff. I mean, everybody says this guy knows this stuff about methane, but nobody wants to believe it. It's just like so.
And you know him, right?
I've never spoken with him. I've emailed with him many times, but I've
was hoping I could enlist you.
I don't know if he can talk or not.
I was hoping to enlist you in trying to get him on the air.
I could send him an email, but again, I've never spoken to him. Who knows if he can talk on the radio or not, but we can find out.
Okay.
Interesting.
All right. Well, is that a significant threat? I mean, do you buy into it?
I don't. My oceanographic friends say they don't think that methane could come out in those types of bubbles. They worry much more about frozen methane. These are these gas hydrates, the so-called clathrates. And methane is frozen in very cold permafrost. We know there's great reserves of it, not only underwater, but in cold water, far to the north and even in permafrost. And that the thing about this is a feedback system. A feedback system works that, you know, the more it goes on, the more it goes on.
Right.
The more global warming there is, there's a feedback. And this works with methane. As the Arctic gets warmer, more of this frozen methane pops out into the atmosphere. And so the next year, a little farther north, it's warmer than it was the year before, and a little more methane comes out. Methane is by far the most effective greenhouse gas. Methane is far more effective than carbon dioxide.
Well, this is what I've been worried about, is this triggering point. Now, scientists are agreeing pretty much across the world that the global warming is certainly going on. What they don't agree about necessarily is whether there is a cascading type trigger moment. I mean, we all know that, for example, when we have ice melting, let's say in the north part of the world, up at the North Pole, as it melts, we then get more ocean instead of ice, which reflects light. We then have water, which more or less absorbs that light, adding to the heating, and that it's a cascading event. Now, is there a moment, do you believe, Peter, there's a moment, a trigger effect moment, when all of this, you know, cascades out of control?
Well, that's the hardest and most interesting of all questions. There's a big group of people who are looking for what they call tipping points, where you tip over the edge, just like you're falling off the dock, and there's no coming back. And the tipping point can be in any number of factors. It could be runaway global warming. It could be changes in the freshwater system. But the tipping point towards global climate change, the debate is whether or not we've passed it. In other words, we're going back to the previous part of the conversation. It could be that nothing we do now, we're a train that's heading down a cliff, and there's nothing we can do. Whereas others say, look, too early to know. We haven't hit the tipping point. We can still pull back. You know, it's not too late. The train can be turned around, and no one quite knows. But the tipping point really is going to involve levels of carbon dioxide. There is some level. There's going to be some magic part per million, at which point, once we surpass that, it's over. And we're going.
Well, are you one who subscribes to that particular view, Professor?
I certainly subscribe to the tipping point. I don't know whether or not we've hit it or not. I'm a paleontologist. I look at the deep past and dabble in other things. But the physics of high atmosphere gases are really scary. I know enough to know that the models that have been put forward now, and they're very complex models, I'm trying to predict future temperatures, are very poor. And what's the problem is that these very complex models really can't model clouds. Clouds have a huge effect, of course, on global temperature. High clouds reflect back, whereas lower clouds don't. What I do know is that the climate people I've talked to have suggested that if we continue to globally warm the world, we're going to see clouds in a position in the atmosphere where humans have never seen them before. For instance, in the Arctic, there will be very high cloud cover that totally obscures really the blue sky. And this guy David Battisti and I, again, the next book after From Thin Air is called Under a Green Sky, because our calculations suggest that the globally warmed world will no longer have blue sky but green sky.
And Professor, I think that you concentrate on the past. Well, there's really nothing like the past for predicting the future, is there?
That's always been my thought. I've spent my life staring at my feet because that's where the rocks are, but it's surprising what you can see about up above your head by looking at your feet.
A green sky, huh?
Yeah, we think it's not pure green. It's going to be just a faint green tinge to it. And this is because in a globally warmed world, you're going to have cloud systems, water systems at altitudes we don't have now higher. And the physics of it is that light is going to refract through them to produce a very slight green tinge. So there'll be a blue-green sky. So the book one, it's a two-parter. Book one is out of thin air, and book two is under a newly green sky. And one is on oxygen, and the other is on carbon dioxide and carbon dioxide catastrophe.
Well, it seems to me that, for example, at the North Pole, if we had a lot of high clouds that we do not now have, at night, we depend on a lot of cooling, atmospheric cooling because the clouds are not there. So if there are clouds there, that's going to prevent the cooling that would normally be freezing that ice nice and tight, right?
Yeah, but these clouds would be so high, they're not going to be like our nice low clouds, which hold heat in. And the second deal, Art, is the scenario, the ice is gone. I mean, we're really shooting towards an ice-free Arctic very rapidly. And with the ice gone now, the other really strange thing to happen, according to the climate people, is that you get a huge amount of lightning. The air will still be cool there, but the oceans will have warmed up to the point. You've got a great disruption, a great difference between air temperature and sea temperature, and this is going to produce lightning on an unprecedented scale. There's very little lightning up in the Arctic now, and the big change will be these high clouds. The second change will be this enormous amount of lightning taking place. And, of course, the third change is already happening. We're dumping so much carbon dioxide into the ocean, it's rapidly becoming highly acidified. The highest acid contents are now in the North Pole oceans. It's so acid that pteropods, which are small mollusks at the base of the food chain, these are planktonic, tiny little shelled organisms, the shells are dissolving off their back. And with the loss of the pteropods, you're wiping out the base of the food chain in the Arctic. And so we're predicting the start of what I call the global warming and extinction, or the greenhouse extinction, begins in Arctic oceans with the disappearance of planktonic species and then works its way south.
Well, a lot of people say, well, who needs plankton anyway? Who cares? I mean, there's a lot of that around. Who cares? Who cares about the ice? Who cares about the plankton? When should they begin to care?
Well, you know as well as I know that a huge amount of the world's protein comes from fish, and that the fishing fleets, where do they go? I mean, I live in Seattle, but nobody fishes here. Everybody jumps in their boat and heads to Alaska and the Arctic area. Those are the richest fishing areas of the Northern Hemisphere.
That's
conversely,
right.
Where do they go? They head down towards South America into Antarctic waters because the high Arctic and the high Antarctic have so much planktonic life that they can support enormous stocks of fish. The strange thing, I spent some time in the Philippines working. I worked at Dumaguete City and Negros. I was working on earlier in my career on the biology of the chambered nautilus. And at that time, the fishermen down at Dumaguete City were strained. It was after dynamite fishing and after cyanide fishing, and there was really no fish left. And they were eating what they called itty-bitty fish. And so we'd have itty-bitty fish meals. But the stocks of fish are higher in the Arctic, and they're higher in the Antarctic. And if we lose that fishery, then we have one more foot into the famine grave. And this is why you don't want acid Arctic or Antarctic oceans. The base of the food chain is what further down the chain feeds all those fish that we humans eat. So we're shooting ourselves in the foot with the acidity, and it's all from carbon dioxide.
So when somebody says, who cares about the plankton, they better care.
Indeed. I mean, absolutely, indeed. Remember the wonderful old movie with Edward G. Robinson, his last movie called Soylent Green? And there was, it turned out the plankton had died. The politicians didn't tell anybody. And Charlton Heston was the hero, and he stumbles upon this. And everybody was given food in this terrible post-apocalyptic world. And it turned out all the food was the dead humans, because with the plankton gone, all there was to eat were humans. Soylent Green. I'd love to buy that and make a remake. Maybe with the partners, Art. That'd be a great deal.
Maybe it's time for a remake.
A remake? Try to get the rights to that one.
Well, I'm sure that by now, Professor, we've generated a zillion questions in the audience. So when we get back from the break, what I'd like to do is allow them to ask questions. I have no idea what will be coming your way, but with all we've suggested, there'll be quite a bit, I'm sure. We live in a pretty troubled world right now, where the North Koreas and perhaps Iran are getting close to nuclear weapons, but that may not make a hell of a lot of difference in view of what you've just described as going on in the world right now. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to sort of turn the audience over to you and let them ask questions.
Sounds good. I'm already getting emails, and I've been simultaneously trying to answer those while I'm talking to you, so I'm happy to keep going.
Oh, now that's rough to do, write an email and be a guest on the radio at the same time. But if you can do it, more power to you.
They're one-fingered, and they're rather curt.
All right, Professor. Professor Peter Ward is my guest. I'm sure we've generated enough for you to have questions. If you know the phone numbers, you can line up now. If not, we'll recite them for you when we get back.